Does anyone else feel like they could eat a lot healthier if they just weren't so busy? The recent game changer for me, meal kits from Sunbasket. John and I have been cooking with the Sunbasket kits that are delivered straight to our door, and it is so fast, so easy, and so good. And it is thrilling to walk into the kitchen and whip up an easy meal like salmon burgers and seared squash, steaks with chimichurri and harissa roasted sweet potatoes. I joke that I can't cook, yet Sunbasket transforms me into a chef, a really good one, I might add. And I just have to tell you, I had strawberries from Sunbasket that were so flavorful. It was the best tasting produce I have had in years. And it turns out Sunbasket works with very specific farms. Go to sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime today to save $120 off your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime to save $120 across your first four deliveries plus free shipping on your first order.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Hello, Hidden Gems. Hello, hello.
Hello, everyone.
We have a very special guest with us tonight. So why don't we bring in our guest, I believe, for his very first ever live interview. I called him Attorney Wood, and he said, please call me Rob tonight. Call me Rob. So we have Prosecutor Rob Wood. And you know what? Just so you know, in this chat, we have this live chat, Rob. We have, it looks like, Colby Ryan is here. And we have Megan Connor, some family of people. And I believe that some of the Tammy's family will also be joining us. So, we are so honored to finally be talking to Prosecutor Rob Wood how long has it been? Four and a half, 5 years
four
now?
Four and a half years. It'll be 5 years November 4th for me.
Okay. Wow. And I believe, as you've said before, not a day goes by that you, in those years, that you haven't thought about this case, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You doing okay? Have you aged? Have you
hanging in there? You know, so many people about 2 years ago started saying to me, you look like you've aged 10 years. and when I do look at pictures of me prior to November of 2019, and then now, yeah, I feel like I've aged a lot. Having said that, I feel like, I don't know, I feel a lot better now. So.
Yeah, good. Kay Woodcock is also here.
Oh, so, good.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. We're all grateful and honored you're here. And I won't tell you anyone else that's here so that you can just relax. I will be honest. You looked like you were working very hard during that trial. You know, I was attending that trial every day, and you did look, I wouldn't say you looked older. You just looked tired, and that it was heavy. I think.
Yeah. Any trial is a lot of work. Even prepping for a 3-day trial, is a lot of work. And we actually, in our office, had prepped for another 1-week murder trial, for earlier this year. And then it settled at kind of at the last minute. So we've had a lot of murder trial prep this year and last year. And yeah, it's trial's a slog, and a trial that long is just, that's really, really long. It's a lot of work, and everyone put in so much work for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I did look tired. I was tired.
You were tired, right? Yeah, legitimately
I was
so.
Really tired.
Yes. It's so good. We're so grateful to finally have you on our show. And I know that, you know, you and I were unable to even talk at the trial because there was a gag order. And I just sort of always knew and hoped that we would be able to have this conversation. And I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation tonight because, you know, and I hope you don't mind if I do this, Rob, but I would love to start honestly with how you learned early on about hidden true crime. Could you take us back to what you've shared with us? Is that okay?
Yeah,
starting there.
So, you know, the case started out early November 2019, really kicked off that week of Thanksgiving 2019. You know, at the beginning, you're obviously not operating with all the facts. You don't know everything that's going on. You don't know the backstory. You don't have all the digital evidence. And just like the basic story, learning that Charles had been murdered in Arizona, that Lori's children were missing. My very initial thought, and again, this is without the benefit of looking at everything, we were kind of like, man, does this Chad Daybell guy know what he's in for? Is he in danger? And as the facts started rolling in, it became more and more apparent that, you know, this was a joint effort, and he's just as much involved. And around that time, I believe it was Ray Hermosillo, I was talking about that with him, like, you know, I think this Chad guy is just as much involved. And he played me, he's like, well, there's this psychologist who has a podcast, and he talked about it, and I can't remember if he played it for me or if he just told me, but that was where something that you guys had talked about after reading his autobiography, which I read his autobiography too. That might be fun to talk about. I don't know.
I don't know if fun's the right word.
Yeah. Fun's probably not the right word. Anyway, so that's how I learned about hidden true crime. I'm not a true crime follower in general. Obviously, my job involves crime, so I deal with it all day. So I usually don't follow true crime outside of work. Every once in a while, there will be a case that, you know, across the country that'll catch your attention. I think in Idaho, you know, we had the Kohlberger case. It's still ongoing. I think that's caught a lot of people's attention. But other than that, I really didn't consume any true crime material throughout the case. And not really much sense either. I haven't, I've kind of taken, I guess you could say, a little bit of a break. Anyway, yeah, that's how I heard about you guys.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. So in other words, this very, very early on, the information is coming at you guys so quickly, you know, but faster than probably you can keep up with it as you guys are investigating. And you're thinking, you know, I think at one point, I mean, kind of like maybe Chad Daybell, the next victim almost, would you say a little bit too, or...
I actually thought that, like, does he know what he's in for? Again, that was the very beginning without benefit of all the evidence coming in and all the investigation, just the basic story, you know, the basic facts that we heard up front.
Yeah. And then here John comes in, and I remember, you know, our first episode, which is I'm sure probably what you heard, was John, I was doing what you're doing. I was like, talk to me about Lori, like, help me process this, you know. And I was following from the very beginning, you know. I was a TV reporter. I had just quit, and then the pandemic came, and this case caught my eye the day that the AP wire came down. John and I, you know, it was 2020, and I'm asking him, tell me about Lori. What's up with Lori? And he said, before we talk about Lori, we need to talk about Chad. That was actually our first episode, and he had read his autobiography. So yeah, I'm sure that's what was pulled up. So. And I think since then, you've probably not consumed any more Hidden True Crime or any other podcasts. Is that right? Because you've got to stay focused.
Right. No. And you know, it's interesting. We were getting so much information from law enforcement. I don't know that we ever even would have, even if we would have wanted to, would have really had time to be listening to other outside sources. And you also want to keep things as objective as possible. Not that other people aren't looking at things objectively, but just, you know, you try and stay in your lane. And I don't really, like I said, I don't follow true crime a whole lot. So.
Right. It's part of your job.
Right.
Description. And that's that. Yeah. And when it is part of your job description, you don't even have time to follow it elsewhere. You have to focus on what you're dealing with.
In hearing that story, I'm just grateful that we helped a little bit, and we helped at least reorient the discussion towards Chad and away from Lori. And actually early on, it's interesting, Rob, because in our work, in our podcast, we got a lot of pushback on that issue. I came in and right away and I said, I think this is looks like a cult and Chad's the one running it. And I was saying this right away. And people were disagreeing with me. They were saying, no, Lori's a black widow. Lori is doing all of this. And that's been a narrative that we've discussed for the last 4.5 years. And so it's interesting to me that that was something that you guys were talking about at the very beginning, because we were actually a little bit controversial and kind of putting the spotlight on Chad. So I'm grateful that if we helped a little bit for you guys to early on to kind of see how Chad might be such an important influence on Lori and on the case, that if that helped a little, then I'm very grateful. So thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah.
Thank you. Did you read, you mentioned that you read his autobiography. I'd love to talk about that. Did you also read any of his other books at all?
Yeah, I did. I read them.
Yeah, well, let's start with the autobiography. Was there anything that stood out in his autobiography for you?
There actually was. What stood out to me, and it's been now 2.5 years since I read it, and I'll probably never read it again, but there was a constant making of excuses for why he didn't achieve the things he wanted to achieve. Whether that was working at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah, he talks about that and how like an interview fell through, but it wasn't his fault. I think if I remember correctly, even talking about high school sports, not quite making it there, and it wasn't his fault. There was always kind of an excuse to be made. And I thought that was really interesting, a lack of personal responsibility. And I think you really see that play out later in his life and with the case. Good things around him happen because of him, bad things. There are things that he doesn't want to have happen, things that didn't happen that he wanted to. That's never his fault. To me, that was kind of the biggest thing that actually stuck out. And then a huge thing for us were when read in conjunction with his other books is at the end of it, where he talks about how, I sell these books under the guise of, they're just books, but they're really actually real revelation for me. That was really interesting to us. We actually kind of used that as the initial preliminary hearing we did back when it was the conspiracy to hide the evidence and destroy evidence case. I thought that was really on multiple levels, both on the criminal level and from a religious standpoint. I thought that was really fascinating that he was then claiming that these revelations he'd received were real. And I felt like basically saying they applied to other people. That was really fascinating to me.
We're jumping into the deep end here right away, Rob, but why not?
Sorry.
No, it's good. We like jumping in the deep end. So, but I mean, you're raising the question of belief. I think one of the questions we get all the time, and we've been having people ask this for 5 years, is does Chad Daybell really believe this stuff, right? And I think you're moving us in that direction with him saying that his books are revelation but fiction. Like which is it? People ask that all the time. And what do you've looked at a lot more evidence than we have, and you've been around these people more than us. I mean, do you have an opinion on whether you think Chad Daybell actually believes that the people that were murdered were zombies, the victims were zombies? Does he believe that his writing is revelation? I mean, what's your take on that?
I have a lot of questions, I guess.
Okay.
I'll probably
save space for you to ask questions too, by the way. Yeah. Let's just talk,
A word that I use a lot in this case is there's a lot of rabbit holes. There's a lot of things that I don't know that we'll ever know. Exactly what did he believe? I don't know. Do I think he believed some of it? Yes, I absolutely believe he believed some of it. Do I think he believed everything he was saying at the end? I don't think so. I think there was a lot of manipulation and saying things to get what he wanted. And I actually think you also see that from Lori as well. She did that as well. So, yeah, and I guess I could go deeper on that. You did see through the trials that, you know, there was a point, unfortunately, in his trial where it came out, he was talking with on an email thread with Tammy and his son, who was on a mission, about 12-year-old boys in his ward that he was calling dark.
Yes.
And, you know, so and you see enough of it that I do think he believed in some of that. The whole zombie thing, I don't know. I think a lot of it became a way to get rid of people he didn't want around.
Yeah. So yeah. You would see that as a rationalization and not necessarily as a literal.
Right. Way. Yeah. I think a lot of what they talked about was rationalization. And yeah, looking at it from, this case is not about religion, but it's impossible to talk about without talking about religion, right? And I really do not believe this case was ever really about the religion. But the religious framework which he comes from, which I'm familiar with because I come from that same church, is so much of what he said is just so absolutely opposite of honestly, core teachings of most of Christianity. And so I have a hard time stomaching that he really believed a lot of those things at the end.
I know what you mean. I mean, one point, for example, and John can share what he thinks, you know, this is actually where we sometimes vary a bit, but I think a great example, what we saw at trial, you guys brought in new evidence, you know, the Ian Pawlowski FBI or the Ian Pawlowski recordings. And when when Chad Daybell is telling Melanie Pawlowski that she needs to then move to Idaho Falls because Hermosillo's dark, and she's saying, but you told me to move to Rexburg, and here I am. And he's like, well, yeah, I said that, but now move to Idaho Falls. That's a part where I'm like, there's no, he knew he was lying about that, didn't he? But I think maybe the question for me, and I'll let John share his thoughts. The question for me is, where do his beliefs end, and where does the BS begin? Because I do think he believed in the LDS faith. You know what I mean? And I think he believed in the second coming. So for me, that's where I like try to process. At what point does it end and begin? But John has, you know, I don't know. What do you think, John?
Well, I think there's these moments like the blessing. I mean, you guys had some amazing recordings of, you know, for evidence that you played. And one of them for me was the blessing that he gave Alex Cox. You know, when I listened to that, I thought, this guy believes this. Like, you can't do that. He's emotional. He's committed, right? When I listened to that, I thought, this is a true believer. He really believes that during this blessing, that what he's saying is accurate, that he sees Alex as a soldier who's anointed to go out and carry out this mission. It is confusing because I think it's not consistent, but there's these moments like that when he's giving the blessing to Alex Cox that just seems so real that it's hard to say, how could he not believe this? He seems to in that moment.
I think that's a really good point there. I think there are, and let me start with this. I think that the one thing that Chad Daybell truly, truly believes in is in Chad Daybell, and that any religious justification he needs for himself, I think he really believes those things. Even that blessing was very self-centered. You're here to protect your sister, who's his, you know, mistress and wife. You're here to as a warrior, what for? Well, everything that Alex went to war for benefited Chad. And so, at some level, I think it would probably be naive to say he didn't believe in any of it. I think, though, that I think when you look at everything as a whole altogether, I think there's so much justification, though, that I have a hard time, again, believing that he believed everything he said. I don't think he thought JJ and Tylee were zombies. I don't think he thought that at all. but that, you know, I could be wrong. And, and the one thing, I mean, legally, a lot of it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
From our perspective as prosecutors, there's a lot of things people want to know that, I'm like, yeah, that's interesting, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
In a case, in terms of the law, does it matter in other aspects? Sure.
It's nice to be talking to Rob, though, too, and not, prosecutor Rob. But, right, yeah. I agree. It doesn't matter in terms of law.
Of course, you know, as law enforcement, have we talked about that? Absolutely. Have I thought about it a lot? Absolutely. When you see such horrific things happen and you go to, you know, I think it's very human of us to say, well, why did that happen? One of the explanations, well, they believed X, Y, and Z, you know, and I don't know. It's almost easier to stomach what happened if they really believed everything they said, you know, cause then it's delusional and sick, right. And not some level of evil. I do really believe, though, when you look at the evidence as a whole, I don't think he really believed that about Tylee, JJ. I don't think he believed that about Tammy at all. Now, did he believe in his own inherent self-righteous greatness? I don't know if that made sense the way I just said that, but yeah, I think he did believe. And I think all of his beliefs emanate from that.
Now, before we continue, a quick word from our sponsor, because Gems, as a busy mom and a journalist who needs to make every minute count, whether working or creating more quality family time, insomnia is not my friend and it can throw everything off. When it comes to work, I like my alone time and starting before the sun is up so that I can switch to motherhood as soon as the family wakes. And if I am up all night worried and fretting and my mind spinning until 3 a.m. because that's what insomnia does to me, I might as well kiss the next day goodbye. And not just for work and my to-do list, but for everybody I love. I have no energy, no time, no schedule. So how did I used to solve this? I used to try those over-the-counter sleep aids, but those came at a cost. The cost was grogginess the next day, no matter how much caffeine I drank. And that is where Dream has been a game changer for me and for our entire family, honestly, so much so that is why I am sharing the good news, because Dream is a revolutionary approach to sleep in the form of a guilt-free, indulgent hot chocolate with natural sleep-supportive ingredients. And get this, just so everybody is aware, because I'm sure many people are wondering, yes, it is gluten-free, it is dairy-free, it is vegan, it is non-GMO, and it is keto-friendly. It allows me to fall asleep, stay asleep longer, and then I wake up refreshed without the grogginess. I wake up energized and ready to get to work. I actually feel less stressed, so it helps my emotions. I feel completely rested and alert all day, even feeling like I can be more emotionally present as a parent. It is an amazing bedtime routine that I have now used for nearly a year. Our whole family has benefited and knows the routine. And mostly, they've benefited because better sleep means a better you. It is a low-calorie drink. I wind down each night, just 15 calories, no added sugar. I sip it about a half hour before bed, give or take. I've also made Dream popsicles to enjoy this summer in this heat wave. I've recently been loving the capsules during this 115-degree weather. Dream has given our Gems an awesome deal for their first order. So head to shopbeam.com/hiddentruecrime. The link is also in the podcast notes. You can go click it there, but it is shopbeam.com/hiddentruecrime, shopbeam.com/hiddentruecrime. And then use the code TRUECRIME to get up to 35% off at checkout. Now realize, typically our show code is Hidden True Crime. This is just True Crime. True Crime is a code to get up to 35% off at checkout. Shopbeam.com/hiddentruecrime. Use the code True Crime. Let me know what you think. Let's get back to our episode, but tell me how you feel. Tell me what your thoughts are on this. I hope that it changes your life as much as it has changed ours.
I think part of that, I like the way you put that, Rob, in terms of the self-righteous greatness. Part of assigning this idea of zombies to a lot of the victims, though, I think it's hard to separate those. That if you believe you have this, to use your term, self-righteous greatness, then you also have this power to assign people to this category of zombies or dark and light, right? And that was another thing, actually, that I talked about in his autobiography. He's doing his mission in Trenton, New Jersey. and he's in the projects, he's in, you know, this ghetto area, and he's going from apartment to apartment. So at that time, he would have been like 19 years old, roughly, mm-hmm. give or take. And this is before, obviously, this is before any murders, any harm is done to anyone. He talks about how he starts to see people as light and dark, even back then. And the autobiography is written in 20, I think it's released in like 20, what, 16?
I think so, yeah. I thought it was 20. You could be right.
But, you know, that really caught my attention, that even going back to the autobiographies, he's starting to see the world in these same, you know, binary opposites, this dark and light. And he goes into, you know, to talk to someone in New Jersey, and he sees an evil spirit. And to me, that was really fascinating, because in some ways, like, he's already doing this when he's 19.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. I do think, though, you know, light and dark is a concept in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and a lot of religion. I mean, it's not a foreign concept, right? The idea of there's lightness, there's darkness. The idea that there are light and dark spirits is very rooted in Christian scripture. And so, yeah, I don't have a problem believing at all that he believes in those things. When you start, I think, to me, kind of the breaking point of where I question what he believes is when it's, do you really believe these victims, these people that you are conspiring to murder, are evil? That they're dark? I don't buy that from him. Does he believe in light and dark? I'm sure he does. I think where the rubber hits the road with these crimes, though, is where the separation starts to occur for me. And that's just me. I'm sure there's people who've worked on this case who see it differently than me. I just think that where the crimes they end up committing are so removed from the beliefs he claims to have for so long in his life, that I think it's, you know, to me, that's kind of where the separation of, I begin to question what he really believes there. But yeah, I think you're, yeah, he does believe in light and dark. He believes, I really believe he thinks he has the ability to discern who is light and who is dark.
Yeah.
To the point of becoming a zombie, that's where I'm like, eh. And what, you know, what they term a zombie is different than like what a zombie is in a movie, but basically a possessed person, you know. But yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah,
I think it becomes a bit of a slippery slope, right? When you start going down that path when you're 19, and you know, he does use the term evil spirits in his autobiography. You know, when you start going down that path and you start, like you said, Rob, that you do believe that he believed he could tell people that were dark from light. How do you stop the train, right? Like, if you keep going down that path, does it get to a point where, you know, that you start dehumanizing people? And if you dehumanize someone and they're the way of obtaining your goals, does it lead to murder? I mean, in most cases, it won't.
Right. Yeah. It kind of gets to the core of the question of the case for me, is what pushed them to go that far. You know, they could have achieved a lot of what they wanted to achieve without murdering anybody.
Right.
Other than the money, you know. and to me, that's really where the crux of the crime lies, actually, is mostly in the money. But what's interesting to me, is, and I mentioned it earlier, though, is where so much of it breaks from not even LDS theology. I just would say general Christian thinking, you know.
Right.
I don't know that it's completely anti-Christian to say that someone has an idea of what's good and what's evil, and if they see that in someone else.
Right, Christ cast out in the New Testament. Christ cast out evil spirits.
Right, he cast out. Evil spirits in the New Testament. Right, he cast them out, and yeah, there's that aspect of that, and but just getting to the idea of giving you the power of over someone else's life.
Yeah,
the execution of an individual. That's, to me, that's just where that, it's just that separation point. So,
well, I'm going to jump in here quick. So the question you asked is what push them to go that far. I agree with you. I think that's the question we've really been trying to answer for for 5 years. And so part of what you said is that it was money, but could you elaborate on that a little bit, maybe?
And I think we talked about this a lot at trial, so I'm really comfortable saying it.
True.
You know, the theme of both trials essentially was money, sex, and power. I felt like at her trial, money, sex was more, the thing. I mean, we said money, sex, power for both, because it, right. You can't separate it, but I think he enjoyed exercising power over people. I think he really enjoyed that, just from things Tammy's family have said. And I think, I'm not saying Chad Daybell was always a murderer, but Chad Daybell was always the same person he is today.
Yes.
At least I would say from the time he was a young adult. I think you see from his autobiography that he's that same guy. And I think he really enjoyed exercising influence over other people. I think he was hoping to obtain, that's the wrong word for it, but I think he was hoping to become higher in LDS church hierarchy. I think he wanted callings that put him in a position of apparent authority over people. And I think that's all based in the evidence that we put forth in trial and just all the stuff that we reviewed. But yeah, and then I think money was a huge motivator for them. When you look back at the evidence, money is always this underlying theme. You know, Colby actually, I think you said he's here. He testified to that at his mother's trial. And I think money was a huge motivator for them. I honestly probably see money as the primary motivator for the crimes. That's just me. Again,
yeah.
Like other people can look at this and see it so differently. But for me, that was kind of the primary motivator for the actual crime.
Yeah. And thanks for sharing your thoughts. Yeah, everyone sees it so differently. And that's why I think it's something, and the rabbit holes are real. That's why it's something that we can discuss for as long as we have. It leaves so many questions on the table, even after, you know, the convictions.
So,
discussing this with us, I'm sure it's affected your life in many ways. Yeah. Anything else, John?
Well, I was just going to, Rob just mentioned the issue of power and how important that was to Chad. I totally agree with that. I think Lauren, you and I talked about in one of our early podcasts about how you and I both believed that he really wanted to be bishop and he never accomplished that goal. I think that really affected him. It wasn't just about being bishop. It was about getting some recognition from the church too. I think he wanted recognitions for his books, even though they were fiction. I think he was hoping that he'd get some shout outs from some of the higher authorities in the church, and that wasn't happening. So, you know, I think some of that runs together. Well, do you have any thoughts on that, Rob, or do you want to add to that, Lauren?
Yeah, I would like to add to that. I think beyond power, money, and sex, one specific word that you used with Chad Daybell in opening statements was significance. You said he wanted to feel significant. And that's actually a word John has used too in our podcast, his desire for significance. And I noted that in your opening statements. And one thing that John and I talked about, going back to what John is implying, I refer to it as bishop envy. In our early podcast days, that I thought that Chad had bishop envy, that in the LDS faith, it's a lay clergy, it's service oriented. You are called for, it's not like being a preacher where you necessarily go to school and you become a preacher. It's a lay clergy, it's service oriented. You're called by someone in higher authority from you to be a head over the entire congregation or ward in the LDS faith. And the bishop leads the ward. It's like the preacher of the congregation. And I suspected, and from my research and from what I saw, that Chad Daybell had bishop envy, that he felt he was supposed to be bishop. And that never happened. And that's even why he moved to Rexburg. That's what I suspected. And so I'm curious what you think there. You've got a smile on your face.
I think you're exactly right. I think you're exactly right. We know that he wanted to be a bishop. And I don't know that ever really came out at trial that much.
It didn't. That's why I wanted to ask.
But yeah, no, I think you're spot on. I think he 100% wanted to be bishop. I agree, actually. I think that's part of the reason he came up here. There was a change in the bishop at his ward in Springville shortly before that we're aware of. And yeah, I think that's a very, to me, you know, I don't know how it affect the case. Yes, not legally, but in the terms of who he is and what he did. Yeah, I think that's spot on.
Is that one reason he moved up to Rexburg, thinking that maybe he'd have some more opportunities there? Or do we know that?
I don't know if he thought he'd come up here and become a bishop. You know, Rexburg is one of the most concentrated LDS communities probably in the world.
Correct.
I think it's 94-95% LDS and a very large activity rate. So there's a lot of people to choose from. So I don't know if he thought he would come up here and become bishop. But no, I think you're the way you see that. To me, I see that the same way with him. I think most people who know about him think that.
Yeah, thanks for confirming what we've suspected and thought. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to it sounds weird to compliment you on, again, things that you did at trial, but I thought that word was well used. I feel like Chad Daybell wanted to be significant. And John talked a lot about that in our podcast too, sort of like what was it called? Death anxiety, John? It's a very specific term.
Yeah, that would be the most straightforward way of putting it. I think it goes back to what Rob talked about at the beginning of our interview, is that in his autobiography, he never takes responsibility for everything. And the reason he's not taking responsibility is because he's, as you pointed out, Rob, he has all these shortcomings or these failures. I think when he gets into middle age, that's starting to catch up with him. You know, he wants acknowledgement and validation for his books. And when he's going to these conferences and people are finally paying attention to him, I think he feels like he's kind of making up some lost ground and getting some attention. And I think that was a part of this too. And then when Lori steps in and, of course, gives him, you know, the even more attention in a relationship and kind of like his ideal relationship, then you're at that point, you're throwing a match into a powder keg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask, I mean, there's a lot of things I want to ask, but so Julie Rowe, that's another person that, I mean, she came up in Chad Daybell's trial actually quite a few times in the end, more than Lori's. And in our podcast, you know, in sort of creating Chad Daybell 2.0, as you say, he was always the same person. Absolutely. She played a big part in sort of this transformation, in my opinion. This is in my opinion. And I guess I should have also said too, by the way, if Rob can't talk about anything, you're just going to say no comment, we're going to move on. But
right.
Did Julie Rowe come up in any of your evidence or the research, or did you find her important in this case?
I think Julie Rowe, I think maybe the big, and this, I think it's interesting from my understanding, and so I hope I'm factually correct here. He published one of her books about near-death experiences.
That's factually correct. Yep.
Yeah, did fairly well from my understanding. And then all of a sudden he's had a near-death experience that gets published later in his autobiography. I want to be really careful what I say. Those type of stories to me are always suspect. I'm not saying people haven't had near-death experiences. Anytime I hear about something like that, it's suspect. But I think that, and this is again where I go back to, I think Chad believes in Chad. When he saw that was a way to make money, all of a sudden then he had one as well. So I think in that aspect, did she contribute to this specific case, though? I don't really think so. I know she talked about it at the beginning. There are some people up here who in Rexburg who are friends with Julie Rowe and would say to me, like, did you hear that she said this about where the kids are? And so I heard these things that she was saying at the beginning of the case. I'm aware that at the very beginning of the case, she said, oh, there's no way Chad Daybell would have done any of this. And right. then And then it became, well, maybe there's some darkness around Chad, but there's darkness around law enforcement. I remember hearing that the kids were on Lihue Beach. I remember them, someone telling me that she said that. And then next thing I knew, she was on a TV thing talking about how Chad had sexually assaulted her. So, you know, a real change in what she was saying. But in terms of the actual case, no, she really did not factor in.
Thanks. Yeah. I would like to ask you, hardest day of the trial for you, Chad Daybell trial.
The hardest day of both trials for me were autopsy photos. And I get, you know, when you do a case like this, when the kids were found, like good prosecutors, we went out to the scene. Chad's trial was brought up. The prosecutors went to the scene, and as if that wasn't supposed to happen, but prosecutors go to the scenes of crimes. So we were there. Multiple prosecutors from my office were there when the children were found. I helped draft that warrant and the probable cause to find them. And it was very obvious that it was very difficult to see that. It was very difficult to see that a young boy had been thrown away like a piece of trash. And then to see what they had done to Tylee. And then you put it in a box, right? I think that's kind of a skill I learned in the military. You put some things in a box, and for a time, you know, you always have to open the box eventually, otherwise it will explode. But you put it in a box, and when probably the thing to me that I remember almost the most, and probably the hardest about Lori's trial, and then going through it again at Chad's, I think I was more prepared for Chad's, but. You know, I was there when the children were found. We attended the autopsies of those children. Hmm. And so I was very familiar with what the picture showed. I'd seen it with my own eyes. But then, like I said, sorry, I'm being kind of wordy. This is hard to talk about, but you put it in a box. And we actually showed as few of pictures, autopsy photos, as we felt like we could to tell everything that the witness, that he needed to be able to testify to what he needed to say. And I remember showing him pictures of JJ and looking over at the jury and seeing their reaction. And not that I didn't know how horrific it was, because I did, but because I had kept it in this box for so long. I remember looking at them in Lori's trial and I just said, holy crap, this is really, really bad. And again, not that I didn't know it, I knew it. It just really hit me again how horrific it was. And that, for me, probably of both trials, was the hardest. Especially the pictures of JJ, because he still looks like JJ.
Right.
And the public, I think the judge made a good call that we weren't going to show those to the public. And he has sealed those, and I don't think people don't need to see it. But it was that was just like gut-wrenching for me. And for Chad's trial, the anticipation of that day, negative anticipation, I guess I would say. That to me, that's the hardest part of the trial, was showing those pictures. Another day that actually kind of surprised me at how kind of difficult it was for me at Chad's trial was listening to Tammy's children talk about her the way they did. And I don't want to say much more than that about it, just that it felt, and I hate using the word feel or felt in a case like this, but it just felt bad to hear Tammy be talked about by her own children the way she was. Especially when I just don't believe that she was the way they described her.
Right. That was hard.
Sorry, yeah. So long answer. Those were the hardest things of the trials.
Thank you for sharing.
Many think you need a lot of money to invest, but Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. In fact, you can get started and invest with Acorns with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. And now, Acorns is putting their money into your future. Open an Acorns Later IRA and get up to 3% match on new contributions. That's extra money for your retirement. For me, investing often gets put off because it doesn't seem urgent, but it's important to start even with a small amount. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client testimonial. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorn Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorn.com/hiddentruecrime. Hidden True Crime is prepping to record live podcasts on the road while meeting many of you along the way. We want to connect to all of our gems without language being a barrier. Enter the most trusted language learning program, Rosetta Stone. It immerses you in a language you're learning, and it's available on desktop or app, perfect for on-the-road learning. We're excited to learn Spanish, French, Italian, Korean, and more. Excited to speak, listen, and think in a new language through an intuitive process, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Join with us. Do not put off learning that language. No better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, Hidden True Crime listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Artifact Uprising is a company that John and I have used to preserve our most special family memories for years. Artifact Uprising is driven by the same belief we hold, that everyone has a story to tell, and they tell these stories through premium quality albums and prints. We purchased their signature lay flat album 8 years ago for our wedding album, and when our son was born, we purchased the same album again to preserve his milestones. Artifact Uprising now wants to help our gems preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want a photo to hang and display or an album with impeccable quality and design to cherish for years to come, we've trusted Artifact Uprising with preserving our most cherished memories and telling our family story from the moment John and I met. And they encourage you to tell your story too. Through the end of the year, Hidden True Crime listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use code HiddenTrueCrime through December 31st.
I know you didn't want to say too much more about the Daybell children, understandably, but I think just one more comment I want to make, and that, you know, in many ways, Chad, I agree, it didn't sound good. But the reason they were there is in some ways Chad allowed them. Like, I mean, I almost want to blame Chad for that too. Like, he put his own children, in my opinion, on display for the world to criticize and judge because he was okay with it. You know, almost like he wasn't going to testify. And this is how I see it. Correct me if I'm wrong. He was, you know, didn't do it. He's going to let his kids do it for him, which I feel like is very Chad-like. But.
Yeah. You know, and I want to, anything I say, I want to say in the light that I respect our the rights of a defendant to present the defense they choose. Yes. Right. That right.
A good defense is important. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it was just hard to hear a victim of such a horrific crime be described the way she was. That was rough.
Yeah. Yeah. It was hard. Anything, John, that you want to say right now?
No, I'm just listening. I'm riveted. Keep going. And your explanation wasn't too long, Rob. It was great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. No, it was, I'm not, you know, not even just being a journalist, not even in the trenches like you are. Yeah, I'll never forget those 2 days at both Lori's trial. And I guess technically I didn't see it as at Chad's, but I did see it at Lori's. And I will never forget. And I agree seeing JJ because he looked like JJ. And I've talked about it enough. I've talked about it. I've shared it on the news, you know, what I've seen too. And it was, yeah, the reality. And I know what you mean by like just how bad it is. You know, we have to move on with our lives. And so you put it to the side and those moments where you're reminded just how horrendous, how unfathomable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For that was the, without a doubt for me, that was the hardest day of both trials.
To skip around a bit, I've just been writing things down as I think. So I'm sorry, this is kind of a bit of a shift from what we're talking about right now, but, Lori's trial. Well, no, actually, let me go to this first. We'll stick to Lori's trial, and this is actually right on topic. When she wanted, speaking of the autopsy photos, when she wanted to leave the courtroom, she didn't want to see those. Do you remember that day? Can you take us back there? What that was?
Oh yeah, that was. I guess. I would skip forward then to her sentencing that Judge Boyce mentioned that, you know, you made everybody else look at them, but you wouldn't.
Yeah.
I remember looking over at her, you know, looking at the jurors, looking at the witness, looking over at her and seeing her look at the ground. At least that's what it looked like to me. Like she was just staring down at the ground. Yeah. I definitely remember that. I remember, you know, we had a small hearing about whether or not she had to be present, and the judge said she was going to be present. And that was really interesting to me. It kind of, to me, went back to the, this doesn't count for me. You know, and that was something I brought up a lot in closing at Lori's, that she would say that to people, this doesn't count for me. To me, that it kind of felt like that. You know, and I always want to be really careful what I say specifically about defendants and what they do in trial. But I thought that was just kind of a, what's the word? Just throwing the responsibility off in a way to me. Like I won't even look at what I've done.
Yeah. To that, I agree. It was a shocking moment in court for me. What about, you know, I thought it was pretty despicable, you know, I'll be the one with the stronger language here, you know, just appalling. But then I saw Chad Daybaugh in trial and how he was completely emotionless to me. This is my opinion. He felt, to use your word, felt emotionless. And then it made me wonder what's worse now? Like, you know, to have some feeling really that I don't even want to see this, even though I'm going to make the jury and everyone in the gallery look at my children that I did this to, and I'm not going to even look, or not even caring, and just the complacency. I don't know, but, and I guess this isn't even a question because I'm feeding you my thought. I'm just sharing my thoughts. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but any thoughts, what you saw or different or? I guess, what are your thoughts about Chad's reaction in trial? Maybe that's a good question.
I think Chad was fairly stoic during trial. You know, I didn't show much emotion. There were times he would shake his head no to things being said. I think he did that a fair amount. I did notice a change in his demeanor. You know, I talked about the autopsy photos earlier. I think in both trials, I felt a shift in tone of the trial. That day changes everything. And I felt like I saw a bit of a shift in his demeanor. I'm certainly not an expert at reading people's faces. So this is purely just me. Some of the thoughts I have. I'm not saying this is
wrong.
Yeah. This is just, I saw at Chad's trial what I would call kind of like micro expressions And I know the cameras weren't very good, so people outside of the courtroom wouldn't see them. But to me, I felt like I saw like changes in demeanor that unless you were pretty close to him, you wouldn't have noticed. But, you know, like I said, I'm not an expert at reading faces. But that's what I felt like I saw.
And what did those micro expressions look like to you? What were they?
The biggest one I saw was when he was convicted. Again, I don't know what he was thinking. I've never spoken to him. But I just, to me, I noticed this kind of change just in his demeanor and in his face, the way he was holding his face. It really stuck out to me. I talked to several people and like the other attorneys about it. Like, I felt like I saw that just kind of a, holy crap, this just happened.
I actually, the cameras weren't great and I wasn't in the courtroom, but I actually talked a little bit about the same. I picked up on something very similar. There was a moment there towards the end when he was convicted where he actually seemed to me like he showed some emotion. And there was it was just a small window. It seemed like it was a window of about 5 to 10 seconds, but the gravity of what happened for a moment seemed to sink in. So I agree, Rob. I said the same thing on one of our shows looking at that. So I don't feel crazy in saying that. thank you for validating. Yeah. Thank you for validating that, because a lot of people didn't agree with me.
Well, and I don't know if everyone in the courtroom felt that way, but that's what it appeared like to me.
Rob, when you talk about kind of these memorable moments, were there any other moments like that really stood out? I know for me, we've talked a lot about Chad, but in Lori's trial, you know, when you guys played the call with Summer, I thought that was extremely powerful. And then Colby, the call with Colby and Colby on the stand, I thought Colby was really exceptional. And those, to me, those were very emotional moments. And I was worried that in Chad's trial that you guys wouldn't have the same type of, you know, juries are very swayed by those types of emotional moments. As most human beings are, I think. But what are your thoughts on that? Were there other moments that you felt were really impactful?
So let me just really quickly address the Summer and Colby phone calls, because they were emotional. They also had a lot of evidentiary value, which is why we played them. Because the things that she said in those conversations. So from an evidence standpoint, not that what Colby and Summer said wasn't important, because it was, but from an evidence standpoint, the things she said in response to their questions and comments were of great evidentiary value to us, her demeanor and her response, and then literally the things she said. And so that's why we played them. And I just want to be clear on that, because you're right, juries do hear the emotion. We didn't play those for the emotion. We played them for the evidence of the things she said. Other things, you know, I think that the greatest kind of trove of evidence was their own communications in the iCloud accounts that we had. And those kind of aha moments, when you start reading those to the jury, you can just see it clicking, like, boom, like, it's not just the prosecutors and cops saying this. It's not just their friends saying that they said this. This is them saying this. And that was, those are kind of, to me, evidence wise, those were like really big moments, those communications between them, their own words. You know, the jail phone call between Chad and Lori from June 9th, 2020, when the property was being searched, that's very powerful. You can hear it in his voice. You know, we could have spent hours playing jail phone calls that would have had evidentiary value and interest to the jury. At the end of the day, it was just, you know, you get past a point of diminishing returns, and those trials were already long enough. But their own words to me are the things that were the biggest aha moments, the biggest, and I believe they were largely convicted based on the things they said to each other in phone calls and texts and communications.
Yeah. Speaking of their words to each other, what were your impressions about, I call them the love texts. It was mostly
the James and Elena story.
The James and Elena.
We always refer to it as the James and Elena.
James and Elena. Right. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was power, you know, that like told, he literally told the whole story in consecutive order.
He did. And what was interesting about that is, and we did this at both trials. We then took that story and started plugging in things that we could establish from that story that really happened. We actually were able to obtain their LDS temple attendance records and plug that into that story. Flights they took, we could plug it into that story. Different conferences they were at, plug it into that story. And so what started out as kind of just a, if I can say, juvenile sexting session. Because I felt like it was juvenile.
Yeah. It was juvenile.
Turned into quite an evidentiary find. And that's, you know, we did bring it up at trial, not because it was juvenile, not because it was embarrassing, but because you could, that was the story. And he told it, you know, Chad Daybell was convicted because Chad Daybell said things. That was a huge part of why he was convicted. He told us where to find Tylee. He told us about their story, you know, and his text to Lori, he told us. And so did Lori. Lori did the same thing in her text, both to him and to Alex. Their communications, that story, again, I think for a lot of people, you maybe don't see the evidentiary value because you're kind of caught up in the substance of it. You know, some of the phrases that get used. I saw a lot of really funny memes after Lori's trial based on the James and Elena story. But evidence-wise, there was a lot of evidence in there. And it allowed us to take his words and tell the jury what happened.
Yeah, he told the entire timeline.
Yeah, yeah. And
yeah, and I want
to
say
that word to me in this case, timeline, is one of the most important words. The timeline is so damning. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, I was just going to actually thank you for, you guys did a brilliant job with that. And I don't think that was lost on anyone, but thank you for taking that story and really amplifying it and filling in the blanks. And it was amazing what you guys did with it. It was extremely impactful. So you guys did amazing with that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Lindsay Blake really kind of led that portion up. And I think she just really knocked it out of the park with that.
Yeah.
Did a job with it.
I noticed the timeline that you guys emphasized. You emphasized it in the opening and the closing. And Lindsay Blake, you guys had a poster showing everything. So going back to what you said, the timeline was so important. And I do know that in talking to some Lori Vallow jurors, someone told me that they emphasized that they wanted you guys to have more of a timeline for Chad.
Yeah.
And so
we met with the jurors a few weeks after Lori's trial, and we actually had put up multiple timelines. And then they said, well, a timeline would have been helpful. My first reaction was like, well, yeah, that's why we had them. But we didn't put it in the opening. And when you're just basically spraying a jury with a fire hose of information, which is what this case was, that's why Chad's in the opening. We put a timeline in the opening because we just, and I really tried to emphasize how important this timeline was going to be in the opening and because of what Lori's jurors had said. And then we had multiple timelines. We had finance timelines. We had travel timelines. When people ask me, how do you think these trials are going to go? I always said, you can only have so many people die around you within this certain frame of time and not be involved with it, right? Like,
yeah,
your married girlfriend's husband dies, and then her kids go missing and show up on your property, and your spouse dies, and someone else gets shot at. You can only have so much of that, you know. There's a limit to the amount of death like that you can have around you without being involved, and that timeline just, I think, hammers that home.
Yeah. Speaking of only so many people can die around you, this is actually a question that has shown up here multiple times, but thoughts on Alex Cox's death?
I'm as bewildered. I'll just say that I'm as bewildered as everybody else.
Okay.
I'll say this. I think I can say this. I was very shocked when we got the autopsy results. It wasn't what I, you know, and you have to be open-minded in cases like these. You don't want to reach a conclusion before something happens, but you know, you do think about, well, could it be this or this? And then when that came down, I was surprised.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's some interesting things though. I believe that, you know, blood clots were involved. He was a trucker. Truckers often have blood clots, you know, like there's just some, it's just really interesting. I'll just say that it's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'll say something. I don't think it was natural. How about that? I'll say what I think. And I'm not even saying that the autopsy is wrong. I do believe that the, you know, that,
they did a very thorough job.
Yeah.
I can say that. I know they did a very thorough job.
Thank you for sharing that, that they did a very thorough job. So I'm not doubting that that is what he died from, a lung clot. I just, maybe there's a part of me that wonders how, but thank you for sharing that they did a thorough job.
Very convenient timing.
Well, and the Ian Pawlowski recordings after, when they're talking about it after that. Okay, sorry. I won't go down rabbit hole. We'll stay focused. Rabbit hole. We'll stay focused.
I think I'm going to stay with Rob's answer on that one. So, yeah, maybe there's elements of the autopsy that I don't know about, but I mean, maybe there's certain toxic substances that they can't find. I don't know. There's a lot of theories out there, but it does seem like really peculiar timing.
Yeah.
The timing is, you know, I don't think. Yeah, it's strange timing. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, that happened in the very early phases of the investigation. And it was like, guess what just happened? It was like, holy crap. That was pretty nutty.
John, do you have anything else? I was going to kind of jump to something else I want to ask. Well, actually, no. Lori Ballow's beliefs. I want to ask you that. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about Chad's, but Chad isn't going to have Chad isn't going to have the sentencing that Lori had. And we heard Lori speak at her sentencing, and we heard her seeming to believe in some very bizarre things. I know that, you know, Judge Boyce mentioned, you know, a personality disorder she has, and, you know, some things were mentioned, but, well, let me ask, do you believe Lori believes it?
Yes. And I do, you know, as we talked about before we came on, I have to be careful what I say here, but I think I can say this. This is probably, to me, I've thought probably more about this myself than what Chad believes. I do believe she believes it. I believe she believes it more today than she did yesterday and the day before that and the day. And I certainly believe she believes it more now than when the crimes were committed. Mm-hmm. And I think you can go back and see through interviews of witnesses that they did on TV and things that there were things that she wasn't fully, you know, I believe it was Melanie Gibb on a TV interview said something to the effect of that she said, if Chad's a devil, he's a good one.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and that, to me, that shows some doubt. That shows some questioning.
Yeah.
And this is 100% just me. Just.
Right.
My Rob opinion.
Wood, not Attorney Wood, Rob Wood.
Just. I think that.
Rob unplugged.
People can choose to believe things that may even seem delusional to assuage their own guilt and trauma from doing things, trauma from committing horrible atrocities. And to me, that's kind of how I see that. I'm not a psychologist. I literally took one psychology class in high school and not even one in college. So, that's kind of how I see it now. But I also want to be very, very clear. I said this at sentencing, so I feel very comfortable saying it here. I never saw any evidence whatsoever that her belief was so overriding or so controlling that she didn't know right from wrong and that she didn't have a choice. And doing this job, you do every once in a while meet someone who is so. I'll say that we had a murder in 2018 in Rexburg. It was the first one we'd had in like 20 years. And we've actually had multiple since Tylee and JJ. This murder before, we had someone, interestingly enough, also believed her victim had a dark spirit. It was her father. She shot her father, and she was telling law enforcement that her father's spirit had told her to go kill the body because an evil spirit was in it, which was kind of weird to me when everything started coming about Lori Vallow. It was like, and Chad, like, oh my gosh, this isn't the first time I've heard this. But the person in that case, she also, I think, was with it enough to form the intent, but was so much more involved in the delusion than Lori Vallow was, so much more. And so what I'm trying to say is, does she believe it? Yes, I believe she believes it. I think it's almost naive to think she doesn't. But I also do not believe at all, nor did I ever see anything that led me to believe that her belief system was so overriding that she couldn't control what she did. I think it made her more easy to manipulate. But she also, it wasn't so overriding that she wasn't able to manipulate people around her as well. And I think you look at the one thing that when we've talked to psychologists in this case and other cases, they say more than what people say they believe or see or hear, look at what they do. And, you know, Lori was paying the rent. She had vehicles. She was feeding herself. She was, making all these other rational decisions. And so, yeah, long story short, she believed it? Sure. Did it control her? I don't think one bit. I think she made a decision to do what she did. That's Rob Woods, my opinion.
And I'm going to let John take this, but I want to give you some credit, Rob, when you said you're not a psychologist and you've only taken one class. Some true crime sleuths have spied a DSM manual on your desk.
Yes, I do have a DSM manual.
So there's that.
I think every prosecutor's office has a DSM manual.
Okay.
It's not just for this case.
Okay. But I'll let the psychologist in the room have this conversation with you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts.
I just want to say, Rob, I think you're doing great. And I want you to know that it's not too late to switch professions if you want to come over. So we'd love to have you as a psychologist.
Yeah.
To your point there, one of the most interesting moments for me, for Lori, was when she was pulled into the police station in Arizona. And she gave a brief interview because Charles, you know, he was on the body cam footage complaining that he was concerned about his well-being and his safety. And she basically at that time, she believes the same thing. She's still immersed in this belief system. But in that interview, she's clearly able to separate the context of being with police officers and saying the right things versus her crazy beliefs, right? So yeah, I think that even back then, that was 2019, early 2019, that speaks to your issue, that she could still separate fact from fiction, and she could still function, and she could still walk into a police station and tell the police essentially, no, I'm not crazy. I don't need a mental health evaluation. So I think you're saying something similar.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because I think you talk to any prosecutor who's done it for more than 2 or 3 years, and especially once they start handling felonies, so many people who commit crimes are mentally ill or have a mental illness or something that you can diagnose in the DSM-5, right? But I always say, you know, there's a lot more people with mental illness who don't commit crimes. And one thing, this is completely anecdote, that was interesting to me during this case. Sometime during this case, I can't remember when, I started seeing these Abilify commercials. And I just remember like a lady gets in a car with another car and their friends and wants, have you stopped hearing the voices? But why that was interesting to me, not that it directly related to Lori or the case, but to my job as a whole, dealing with people who struggle with mental illness. Most people, I do think, when they struggle with some form of mental illness, even if it's delusional thinking or hearing or seeing things, go get help. I think that's what a lot of people do. But I just remember thinking, like, that's interesting. Again, that had nothing to do with Lori, it's herself. So there is certainly, in this case, an interplay with mental illness. I don't think it'd be naive to pretend like there wasn't. Again, though, I just go back to, I think her actions showed that she was able to make rational decisions, and she knew what right and wrong was, and she still chose to do what she did.
Can I ask John about, I thought it was really interesting, Rob, how you said that you think she believes it more now than you even did. And I think I agree with you, because there's this bit of a denial that's forming. Like she's so self-protected, in my opinion. That's my thought about it. But John, what are your thoughts about that? Since you, again, you're the psychologist in the room.
I've been experiencing symptoms that many of us at this age experience due to hormonal imbalances. And if anyone can relate, I do recommend Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause, but it's for any woman that has symptoms of hormonal imbalances. It has been a tremendous help for me. And the company Happy Mammoth that created Hormone Harmony, they're dedicated to making our lives easier. And that means using science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. These symptoms can include night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, feeling exhausted all the time. Yes, Hormone Harmony has helped me with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in their reviews. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today. School is back in session at the Matthias House, and having the right food on hand is key to our new busy schedule. Bread and buns are a must-have for school lunches and quick sandwiches, but just because I have my family enjoying bread, make no mistake, it does not mean we're sacrificing our health by loading up on carbs. Hero Bread has completely reinvented the bread and buns that make meals so great, but with a big difference. Hero Bread has 0 to 1 gram of net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Plus, it's high in fiber, and get this, it contains protein. And now they have something special for your fall sliders. They're sweet, melt-in-your-mouth Hawaiian rolls. They have that sweet, light flavor you would expect from Hawaiian rolls, but without the carbs and sugar. Everyone's a fan of Hero Bread. Give Hero Bread a try. You can get 10% off your order at hero.co by using code HiddenTrueCrime. That's HERO.CO. Use code HiddenTrueCrime to get 10% off your entire order. Enjoy your fall favorites guilt-free. While I love trying new styles, I feel like fashion changes faster than I can keep up. Not to mention, I am not a fan of dressing rooms. These are just a couple of reasons why I love renting many of my clothes. Enter Armoire. Armoire allows you to rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion. I signed up. I took a style quiz, and they offer suggestions that best match me. So whether you're planning a date night, packing for a conference, headed to a black tie event, you have the perfect outfit without facing a dressing room with fluorescent lights. With my Armoire clothing rental, I feel brave trying new styles because I know it's not forever, just a week or a month. And my favorite thing, having someone else do my laundry when I'm ready for new clothes. Right now, our gems can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. And that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/hiddentruecrime. That's armoire.style. So armoire.style/hiddentruecrime to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
It makes sense to me. I think she's building that more of a, you know, defensive system or system of belief around what happened so she doesn't have to deal with it. I think Rob kind of actually said that. I agree with that. I think it's, if there is guilt or ever was guilt, she wants to completely push that out of awareness. So I definitely think she's, after the fact, I think she's really trying to figure out a way to not feel and not have to take responsibility or confront what happened.
And just from my perspective, what the day that I really thought, started thinking that was at her sentencing, from the statement she made. That's when it kind of really hit home to me.
Yeah.
Again, not a psychologist, just that's just kind of how I have seen it.
Not too late, Rob.
I don't want to go back to school.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Neither do I.
Yeah, we've kept you a long time. I know that. I had a couple more questions, but John, is there something you wanted to ask?
Yeah. Thanks for spending so much time with us, Rob.
Thank you. Truly, thank you.
We really appreciate it. We've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, obviously, and
like 5 years. So you know.
Yeah, but we're quite aware that we wouldn't be able to do that until everything wrapped up. I think, you know, the Olympics are on now and we're getting to track and field and, you know, they're running sprints now, but they're starting to get into some of the distance races. And I actually, you know, knowing that we were going to talk to you, Rob, there was a marathon or some qualifying for the marathon. And I was thinking about you in this trial, actually. And I thought, you know, marathon runners, when I was watching a little bit, I thought they have to really go through a lot and that, you know, they're training and they're when they compete and you know, I kept thinking, I wonder what kind of a toll that takes on those people. And I kind of thought about you, Rob, in the sense that this seems like to me like you were in a marathon. And I don't know that there's any training that you could ever have for something like this. So in that sense, I mean, did this trial have an impact on you? And if so, could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. It was really hard. It was very difficult. In this case, especially, you know, I felt like I was unjustly attacked for some things in this case. I subjected to some hearings that I felt were ridiculous. And it's hard to have your character slam like that. Having said that, the hardest part though is just, the subject matter of this case. Murder cases are always difficult. Like I said, we've dealt with a few others in our jurisdiction even since these cases happened. And you know, you're dealing with the worst thing someone can do, basically. And you know, so there's a lot of crimes you can, you know, like theft, you can pay someone back. With drug cases, a lot of times we're very concerned with the welfare of the defendant. And then you get a case where someone has taken someone else's life. And I've said this at every sentencing I've done for a murder is that there's really no justice in a murder case in full justice. I think there's a sense of justice that someone is held accountable, but you cannot replace what's been lost. In this case as well, again, this case was not about religion to me, but the religious side of it to me was really it felt dark. I hate saying that, but it you know, I think that's it was there's a darkness to it, it was the case. It took up so much time, and the beginning of it. There was so much, where are these kids? And then you find the kids, you're like, wow, this is horrific. And, you know, it's interesting you talk about a marathon. My mom was a highly competitive marathon runner when I was a child. And so, yeah, I look at all the training and everything that people go into. And this case, I remember when we found Tylee and JJ, I very naively thought, okay, we're going to get this thing wrapped up. And, boy, I mean, I could not have been more wrong, right? We were still so far, 4 years away from the finish line for Chad.
Yeah.
Almost to the day. Like I said, I can't remember if we were already rolling the show when this happened or I've said it before. A lot of people remarked to me that you look like you've aged 10 years. And it's true. It really did take a toll emotionally and physically. But having said that, you draw on your experiences. A big motivator for me was the victims, the little living victims in this case. You just, you want to do right by them. And a big motivator for me were Tylee, JJ, and Tammy. You want to do right by them. I'm not going to go into details about it, but when we had our clerical error on Chad's indictment, there were 2 hours where I was just like, oh my word, we've just.
Yeah.
You know, and the funny thing is it wouldn't have changed the sentence and it wouldn't have changed the outcome, but just, oh,
I
just,
yeah. Right.
It was just horrific. It's just horrific. Thinking, oh,
Rob is. Rob is referring to the moment where there was an error in JJ's death date.
Yeah.
We discovered that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, so I guess I'm getting a little off topic, but just, yeah, it was very difficult. I think for everyone involved, a case like this is definitely going to leave its marks. You know, when people would ask me about it, I would often say, I'd rather go back to Iraq than do this. That was a less difficult experience being deployed in the military than this was. It wouldn't have done to have missed it. You know, I'm very, very proud of the work that we did. The law enforcement performed, that the prosecutors performed. I'm very proud of the victims in this case, the living victims, the way that they've held their head high. And I'm just rambling now. So I apologize.
No, you're doing great. Thank you. Keep going.
Yeah, thank you. And well, let me, can I ask, so that moment, the clerical error, those 2 hours, that was stressful. That was,
yeah.
You can see Blake's face, you know, go like this. And
yeah,
it was a stressful 2 hours for us out there. I remember I bought everyone sandwiches. I was with the Woodcocks. We bought everyone sandwiches. Like, it was just like, I didn't know what to do. So I like ordered food, because that's what I do, is I eat. What was going on with you guys, you know?
Well, when the judge first said it, I was like, well, no, you're wrong, judge. That's not what it says. I had been poring over that indictment for the 3 days before that to make sure we'd met all of our elements. And I, you know, if the date we had in there was the same date for Tylee, and I think had it said something like January 17th, I would have noticed that, but it was just this date that was already in our heads. And that was not a count that we had intended to amend. And so, and that was the argument that the judge found for us on, like, well, you didn't even have permission to change that. Which was, he made the right call, I think. I just brought that up, you know, like, you have these moments where you're just, that are really difficult. I think for everyone involved, I think for the defense attorneys, you know, and I don't want to speak for them. I think this is a really hard case to deal with, to go through a trial like that. And I think they all did a really good job. And murder is just a horrible, horrible thing. It's the worst thing that can be done. And dealing with the aftermath of it, whether it's a case like this that has a lot of media attention or a case that nobody hears about, murder cases are just really difficult, I think.
Absolutely. And this one was horrendous. This one was, you know, the worst of humanity, really. It was just...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was hard. This is a personal question I have, but speaking of hard and the worst of humanity, one part of this case, you know... And this is a personal for you. I want this from Rob Wood Unplugged. This has, because I realize this doesn't have any legal implications, but a lot of this case did have to do with belief and extreme beliefs, or, you know, or whatever we thought. And I know that you're LDS, you know, as am I. And I think I'm curious to know if your faith or was ever tested, or your beliefs were affected, personal beliefs, by processing this case. Because I can tell you mine were a little bit,
it's really hard when, again, I'll say it a million times, this case wasn't about religion, but you can't talk about it without talking about the religious side. And right. It's really hard when you're listening to jail phone calls between Chad and Lori when she was arrested and he wasn't, and they're reading scriptures that maybe mean something to you. And you're hearing these people talk about it. It's really hard, you know, in LDS culture, temples are so sacred. And it's really hard wanting to go to a place that's supposed to be sacred when you know that people have been there, not after they even had an affair or done something, but like killed children, you know? And this is maybe the best way to say this. I remember being at church with my wife. We were talking about the Old Testament and Abraham and Isaac. And I turned to my wife and I said it a little louder than I should have. I didn't mean for anyone else to hear it. I was like, this bull crap. God never told anyone to kill a kid. And I, you know, I don't want to offend anyone with saying that. I don't want to comment on the veracity of that scripture or not, just that that's how I felt at the moment. But, you know, I remember talking with my wife a lot about this. And to me, honestly, the biggest hero of this case for me is my wife, and her even keel and steady dealing with me. But one day she's like, you're not going to allow them to change what you believe, you know, and I think she was right, you know, but yeah, did it make me think about it? Oh yeah, a heck of a lot. And probably will for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And I appreciate your honesty.
One thing just I think has been interesting that has been brought up to me by people that I've worked with. Some people have questioned, you know, it's public knowledge that I'm LDS, and that some people felt like maybe we were helping the LDS church cover this case up, or
I wanted to ask this. Yes.
Yeah. And to me, that was
so a lot of conspiracy theories out there.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, you know, it was interesting, even at Chad's trial, a text that Melanie Gibb had sent me at talking about the church's image. And, you know, it was interesting. He didn't show my response, which was nothing. Mm-hmm. I didn't respond to that because I didn't even know how to respond to that, because the LDS church has their own PR machine that can take care of anything like that. And it never even crossed my mind.
You and Keith weren't trying together to protect the elders, because that's
pretty I've never spoken to Keith Morrison. Yeah. And yeah, no, that was never like a thing for us. Like, because I saw, obviously, because they come from the LDS background, there's these commonalities, but I never really saw this in any way as a referendum, or that's not the right word, but comment on the actual LDS faith or Christianity in general or religion in general. To me, even with how much she believed it and with what Chad may not have believed, religion for them was more of a tool than it was an actual belief system that had meaning, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize by saying that, that's just barely skimming the surface of what I mean. But yeah, anyway, that long story short,
Thank you.
Way to answer your question.
Yeah. And to go further with the conspiracy theory that this is a cover up with the LDS church, yes, it's public record, you're LDS, but the majority are not on this case. And I don't want to get into everybody's religion, but this was, even though it's highly saturated in Rexburg,
very wide variety of religion.
There was a wide variety. That's what I want to say.
People involved with this case. Yeah.
Right. That's what I want to say. I don't want to like pinpoint everyone's religion, but this was not like some big LDS group type.
No, it was not. And again, when some people first brought that to me kind of out of concern, and I've always just kind of thought it was funny. Like, I know that my constituents don't really believe that. And if any of them do, it's not enough to matter. But it was, I don't know, I've always thought that was amusing.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, how you reacted to the verdicts both then and now. What are your thoughts about that?
Thank you, John.
Yeah. You know, the scary thing about a jury trial is you never know what a jury will do. And it only takes one person, one juror to hang it. Which, you know, that's not the same thing as an acquittal. I was never worried that either of them would be acquitted. That was never a concern. To me, there was, to me, the evidence was overwhelming. And I think the jurors have used that word to describe it. It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
I think that not only did we meet our burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, we far surpassed it. And we probably could have made those trials even shorter. But in a case like this, you don't, you know, leave anything on the table. You put it all out there. So my reaction, relief that no one hung the jury and we didn't have to do it again. Relief that they saw the truth for what it was. It's actually interesting to get a jury verdict. There have been times where you'll have a case and even when someone's found guilty, you're like, yeah, this is just a crappy situation. Even if you win, it's a crappy situation. I think as a prosecutor, really, you really want to be nervous about the idea of winning, right? It's about doing the right thing and getting justice. I was relieved and elated that they saw it for what it was. What to me was interesting was with the jury coming back with the death penalty. That's an interesting thing to be a part of, asking for the death penalty. You guys saw the trial. You probably noticed we didn't go in there in the penalty phase and pound our fists on the table. We were just like, this is the law. Do with it what you will. And but when the jury came back unanimous on every single aggravating factor that we had listed, that meant a lot to me. Just that they saw it the same way.
Yeah. It was powerful. That they saw it that way, right? I can't imagine what you felt. Thank you for sharing that. I'm so appreciative of this conversation. And so my last question to you, which is very broad, but how are you doing now? How are you moving on?
I'm doing well. It's interesting when you do have a case like this, how many things you kind of put on hold. Even though you probably do have time to do them, a case like this just takes a lot of mental energy. Things like fixing some sprinklers on my lawn that I just let go for a couple of years, you know, things like that. It's surprising how much you kind of don't do when you get involved in something like this. That your job normally, and I do think this job, it's a demanding job, but normally doesn't, you know, require that much mental focus. So I've been doing a lot of catch up, doing a lot of things, finished reading some books, finished reading Great Expectations by Charles Dickens today. And I've been reading that for like 2 years. But overall, yeah, I'm doing well. Talking with other members of the team, I think people are just really glad that, generally speaking, it's over. The big haul is over, and it as hard as it was, horrible as it was in a lot of ways, I think everyone who was involved is proud of the work we did. And that's a huge thing. And, I've met a lot of really wonderful people through this case. People that I wouldn't have met otherwise, some really great guys down in Arizona, some FBI, people from the FBI. Every experience in life, you take out of it what you will, and a lot of, for such a horrible thing, I've taken a lot of really good things out of it as well. you know, I'm glad to have met the people I've met. You know, Larry and Kay, Colby. They're just a lot of really wonderful people. I think the world of Summer Shiflett. That's someone who I've got, you know, I don't really know her that well, but just a lot of the people we've met, I've just been really impressed with.
Thank you. Jill is saying, thank you to Robert and team for never giving up the fight for justice. I am sure JJ and Tylee will have big hugs for you in heaven to say thank you for loving them enough and to fight for them. And, you know, I want to say thank you too. This case consumed me in many ways, and it didn't need to. It didn't need to like it did you. You know, you had a duty. But the more I learned about it, starting in 2019 when it hit the wire, and throughout, the more I learned, the more passionate I became, and John too, but I'm speaking for myself here. And I couldn't stop caring or talking to people or interviewing people or trying to understand it. And, you know, in many ways, you know, I just want to say thank you, you know, JJ and Tylee, I think, and Tammy, JJ, Tylee, and Tammy are very lucky to have had the prosecution team they did. And so I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to say thank you as well, Rob. You guys did a magnificent job, and we noticed, and we're grateful for that. And this is a case where justice justice was at times it seemed like hanging by a thread, but now it's not. So thank you.
Yep. Well, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. And let's meet up for, if you're in Vegas, let's meet up for some barbecue.
So. Yeah, we owe you one. That's true. Yeah. Two plates.
All righty.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, take care.
Bye.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.